Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Matt Broughton, editor of ExchangeWire, and I'm pleased to be joined by our special guest today, Will King, commercial director of the Media Trust. Will, how are you?
I'm very well, Matt, thank you.
And I'm also delighted to be joined by ExchangeWire's head of content and chief instigator of calamity, Lindsay Rowntree.
So you've got promotion since we spoke last.
Chief instigator of calamity.
Is it a lie?
What have I done in the past 5 minutes that would give you that? Maybe past hour. Yeah. Okay. I have to take it. It's true. Just I fall over everything all the time.
Exactly.
Is that what you're getting at? The fact I fall over everything. Yeah, yeah. I'm just extremely clumsy. Thanks, Matt.
No problem.
Bloody hell. What
should
intro.
Have got here earlier, shouldn't I? It's like I missed all the fun.
No, definitely not. Okay. Honestly.
Okay.
Right. That aside, kicking off with our first news story of the week. In response to the recent investigations in the US by the Department of Justice and Congress Judiciary Committee, basically into all the antitrust practices that Google are committing, or potentially committing, Google have released a post in response on their keyword blog outlining that their view is of a healthy and competitive advertising ecosystem. And they're defending their position within that landscape of being just one of the many offerings on both the demand and the sell side within the industry. These arguments are largely based on an advertiser perception survey, which outlines the average number of demand-side platforms used by marketers and sales-side platforms used by the publishers. Their conclusions are that they're not the only players within the industry and they're not always the preferred partner. The larger ad tech community as a whole has rather sneered at this suggestion over social media. But I suppose the question here is Google preparing themselves for the wider arguments, or do they generally think that they are not being, you know, violating antitrust in this sense? Well,
goodness, interesting. Looking at the content of the blog post, they're clearly laying out a theory. I think lawyers talk about a theory of a case, don't they? So you try and establish the facts and the issues on which you want to have the conversation. And I'm not particularly on top of the processes in the US, but obviously the conversation, we have similar conversations in the UK about Google's position, monopoly or otherwise, in terms of where it sits in the market. I mean, clearly that post is designed to draw attention to the diversity of the industry, and I think it makes a kind of guarded reference to the Lumascape, you know, some kind of a tongue-in-cheek reference there. And if you were to look at the Lumascape, then you would say, well, absolutely, you know, this clearly is a thriving and diverse industry. I wonder what the Lumascape would look like adjusted for scale. You know, if you kind of took, you know, maybe that's a job for those folk to re-edit it. If you took those organisations and kind of adjusted them for you know, turnover or financial position or whatever else it might be. But I think it's just an interesting, I think overall it's just very interesting to note that there is a response. I mean, I'm not sure how much response we've seen from Google around any of this dialogue in any of the regulatory environments in the US or in the UK. There's been an ongoing conversation and murmurs in the industry, but we haven't really had anything from Google. And it's interesting, I guess, just to observe what that communication looks like and to take some guidance on where they chose to make comment.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. It almost feels like they've got a new PR firm. Like there's a couple of things recently where they have brought out their views on things and said, this is what the industry looks like and this is our viewpoint on it. This is a fascinating one. And I just sort of feel like the companies that are mentioned in this would probably saw their name as like cringing, like, oh, please don't bring me into this. I'm not involved in this conversation. And it's a really interesting way of trying to highlight to the DOJ and to the wider world that there is diversity in this industry, because, well, there isn't.
Yeah, and we get quite guilty of sort of pigeonholing our industry and existing in its orbit. And when you start talking, obviously, about regulation, and there's ongoing conversations in the local market in the UK about regulation, the perspective of that conversation changes, right? So what I think as someone who works in this industry about the position of Google is one thing. What the man on the street or the user or the average, whatever, I think the legal term is the average person on the Clapham omnibus thinks about ad tech is probably not a great deal. But I imagine they've heard of Google, and I imagine they've heard of Facebook, and I imagine they have some kind of understanding of how those organisations work. But of course, the myriad of intermediary layers, the other, you know, the other organisations mentioned in the blog, probably less so. So it's, I would suspect it's a scene setting, and you know, the establishment of some kind of a dialogue around what they feel may be coming in terms of regulatory pressure, or whether it be here or whether it be in the US.
Yeah, I think the I think they feel like something is coming their way, and they're trying to just ready themselves for it and not put themselves fully in the spotlight. It's almost like they're saying, you know, they're not just saying we're diverse, but they're also saying there are other companies out there you could probably have a look at too, because it's not just us that's causing this. And they meant, you know, the way they called out Amazon's DSP and said that Amazon is now actually bigger than we are as a DSP, is kind of saying Amazon as a company is far bigger and probably far more nefarious than we are too. So go after them.
It's a bit playground-ish.
Don't come after us.
Like, he did it first. He's bigger than me now, kind of thing.
I know what you mean by that. I think it is to a certain degree. But I think, as you said, Matt, calling out the kind of advertiser perceptions piece on this as well, which they've done recently. They did recently when looking at talking about the future of the third party cookie within the Chrome browser. Mm-hmm. Talking about the fact that we've looked at our stats. We have a lot of data. We looked at our stats and we've worked out that actually there's far less revenue for publishers when there's no third party cookie versus when there is, like when there's a trackable person versus a non-trackable person.
Yeah.
So we decided we're going to do XYZ, and there again there's this that's why I feel like there's this weird, like there's been media trained recently, there's this weird PR stance coming out, and we're looking at different things and taking multiple things into account, and we're now coming out with a rounded argument. But the rounded argument to the rest of the industry is just like, what are you talking about?
It still avoids
about?
A lot of, because yes, there are loads of different players within that. But at the same time, it's, you know, when you look at search, AdSense has, you know, 90% plus of that market.
That would be my observation about it. It's kind of, you know, trying to guide a conversation. You know, as people that work in this industry, the places where we would think and look and say, well, I think there probably is some cases to answer, certainly around search and the way that they use that information throughout their ecosystem, the stranglehold they have on publisher ad serving, the way that they leverage YouTube. Those are probably the highest points of friction for their organization in this type of a conversation.
They haven't mentioned them though.
And that's not the scene setting. You know, I talked about, you know, trying to establish a theory of the case. You know, the conversation is there are many DSPs and there are many SSPs. We are one of them. Please feel free to make a decision. However, that does not fully represent, I think, the full extent of where people may have concerns.
Not anywhere near close. I wonder if they feel like if anyone is to come after us, the one thing that they're going to well, there were two things they probably have to divest. One might be DoubleClick, or as DoubleClick as it exists now.
Yep.
Or YouTube. So if we kind of talk about DoubleClick in this way, then it means they can't come after it, because actually DoubleClick is one integral part of the industry that promotes diversity. They cannot say the same about YouTube because it doesn't do any of these things, and they can't say the same about AdSense as the biggest ad net in the world, and they can't say the same about search because obviously it's you know, it's Google is the biggest search engine in the world, and that's where every consumer comes to. That's not their fault, but also it is their fault, like they're doing. But there's not much they can do about that, but there is a lot they can do about how they monetize it and how they use users and use publishers within that.
And when they control such large swathes of the industry, they're able to set the pricing. And I think that's, you know, if everyone else is playing their game, then that's also what needs to be looked at, and what this blog post I don't think addresses in the slightest.
Yeah, I was kind of looking around for some kind of frame of reference for it as well. And again, I'm not a lawyer, but I don't, in terms of where you find a threshold for like regulatory action, I was just looking back, and do you remember the Asda Sainsbury's merger? I mean, our CMA said no to that at a combined market share, I think, of about 31-32%. And depending on which region you look at, or depending how you tot up Google revenue, they currently stand at somewhere between 35-40% of digital spend. So if we were actually talking about an existing Google business as stands looking to purchase DoubleClick, or an existing Google business as stands looking to purchase YouTube in the current environment, you would expect that purchase may be challenged. I don't know how the reverse scenario is managed, because they've clearly grown what were smaller what were smaller contributors into the strength of the entire Google stack as it is now. And, you know, smarter folks than me have written about how you might unpick what they have now. And the answer is, not sure. practically, how do you go about doing that? I think there was an Ari Papp thread, wasn't there, I think, on Twitter that went into some detail about how the various layers of their ad tech stack talk to each other and how you might try and unpick that.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, whether by design or by coincidence, the analytics requirements and the attribution requirements that sit through that line make it incredibly difficult to make sensible decisions about that.
Yeah, absolutely agree.
Definitely. So moving on to our second news story of the week, basically because the advertising market is so wonderfully bountiful that publishers are able to focus on their core content, the Washington Post has launched their own owned and operated ad network dubbed Zeus Prime in an effort to compete with existing big tech platforms, whoever they may be, and offer direct access to marketers wanting to buy ads from specific publishers in real time. This reflects the greater publisher investment in advertising that we've seen over the last few years. A Washington Post spokesperson has stated that the CPMs will be approximately $10 as opposed to roughly $2 at the moment. Thus, more revenue will be returned to anyone, you know, offering their inventory via this network, as they can cut out third parties and sell directly to marketers. So I think the first question on this will be, what will this generally look like for publishers and advertisers alike?
Looking at the release for the Zeus product, I thought a couple of things about it. I thought first of all, they were talking about launching particularly into the local DC market, you know, small local advertisers and SMEs. And I think one of the things that we probably forget to talk about sometimes in the duopoly versus the rest conversation is how incredible the duopoly are at taking that budget, in terms of people who have hundreds of dollars a month to spend on marketing versus millions of dollars a month to spend on marketing, almost exclusively spend it there. And clearly there is some intention with this product to better service that kind of an ad buying customer, and they're launching it into the local DC market for exactly that kind of an advertiser. So that's the first thing. I think there is a strategic requirement for publishing to be able to better access that money. And they call it mom and pop, don't they, in the US?
The mom and pop store stuff. Yeah.
So that's the first thing. So there is a strategic market growth piece here. Mm-hmm. And I think there is also the continuation of a trend that we've seen in many places, which is the increasing requirement for publishers to start to own a part of the tech layer. As much of that tech layer, perhaps, as they can. Businesses like the Washington Post obviously have the smarts and the budgets to be able to build wholesale. Other organisations are having to take slightly leaner approaches to that, either by licensing or by using adopting open source pre-bid solutions and modifying those kinds of things to their need. But it's something we're going to see more and more of, I think, in the premium publishing space. And I would expect that, having established those kind of four publisher technology solutions, they will then start to kind of cascade down to form larger kind of co-op organizations. You know, we've seen Ozone launch for the National Press in the UK. You would expect that a model like that would grow beyond the founding partners once they've established their processes and their technologies. But as I say, that's the two things. There's a strategic need to sell to more people more easily, in the same way as some of their platform competitors do, and then also to own more of the transaction. So I think that when they talk about, they're not just putting their rate cards up to 10 and saying who's going to buy it. What they're talking about is extracting much more value by dealing directly.
Removing the layers.
Removing the layers, right? So there's less transactional cost, and there's probably a better demonstration of value in going direct to the customers as well.
There was the IAB, I think it was a UK report only, but it's the same rule applies. The report stated that it was the programmatic perceptions, or whatever it was called, something similar to that, that looked at in-housing, and looked at in-housing on the buy side and the sell side, and it looked at the kind of year-on-year trends of publishers taking things in-house and looking at their own tech supply, and obviously bringing their the ad ops team in-house. Mm-hmm. And it is growing, and there is that need to gain more control. And I think, you know, if we look at what's happening in Europe and the challenge that publishers have and the stress that the publishers are under, they want to make sure they are controlling that thing themselves as much as they can do. In the US, you don't see it as much interest, which is interesting, I guess, because they've never really felt they need to because of the scale versus Europe. I don't know. Will, you're a bit more embedded in this maybe than I am, but I find it interesting that this is quite a common thing in Europe, really, in terms of if you look at it from a sales house perspective, and those sales houses then looking to build their own tech. We do see that quite a lot if you look at the heft of, say, Axel Springer, and you look at, obviously, you already mentioned Ozone, and there's that more collaboration and people putting egos aside to try and work better together, and the role that tech plays in that. Less so in the US, but do you reckon we'll start seeing more of that?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, the French marketplace has kind of unified over a long period of time as well, and they have Laplace Media. I think absolutely, right? So I think there's two things about that. I think there will be more, yes, and I think that they will be different in type. So if you look at the attempts over time to, in the UK market, to have that kind of cooperation, there's a fundamental difference between that which Ozone is executing versus that which has come before, you know, pooling inventory on someone else's platform versus the genuine aggregation of assets into a JV where there is a genuine commitment to change the way that they can operate some of those business models. So I guess the structure of previous efforts probably talks to the state of the market at the time. You know, there is, you're able to do what you're able to do with the tools that you have. I think, you know, the skill sets around programmatic execution, the technology that's available now allows more of that flexibility. You know, as I mentioned, a lot of this stuff is, you know, you can start open source and you can develop significant skin in the game without perhaps needing to build an entire SSP, for example. But then I wonder more broadly whether the traditional model of the SSP as an aggregator of inventory to pass into demand is again something that we're going to start to see change, particularly as it pertains to the premium end of publishing. You know, those, in the same way that brands are in-housing their contracts and their DSPs, their buyers, you know, coming closer to the agency, coming closer to the point of execution, you would fully expect for publisher to that same process to continue through publishing, you know, and those with the deeper pockets and, you know, the WAPOs of the world who can go and buy and execute and build will do that first. And you will see that start to run through the publishing industry, I think, as a whole. You know, they would like to be less reliant, and it's a different kind of reliance, I think. You know, the ability to connect your inventory to someone that wants to buy it was only able to do that in a couple of ways previously, and the ways that you can do that now is increasing, and with the right insights and tools and people, you can select the right ways for your organization to do that and start to do that more on your terms than perhaps on the terms that are given to you when you...
Yeah, I get that, and I think also looking at the release from the advertiser perspective as well, like it's taking things almost very back to basics in terms of what Washington Post is trying to launch here, in the sense of the advertiser is able to, there's no coding required, there's no kind of creative formats, it's very, very basic, simple, which is why it's obviously done on a local basis, so it's encouraging SMEs to take part and be involved. But actually the advertiser going in there and just inserting the ad themselves on the publisher page, that feels very very old school and kind of almost like, wow, it's a long time since there's not been like 15 layers of tech in between that process, which I also think is really interesting. And I don't know if they will make that national, because I find that would be to be mind-boggling if they were to make it national and open that up to millions upon billions of impressions, just the advertiser sitting there and inserting the ads directly onto this major kind of national publisher.
But is that, I mean, yeah, but is that any different to the way that my corner shop in Billericay, where I live, might insert its ad into the Facebook feed?
Well, exactly. No, it's not.
You know, is that really any different? Or the way you might access the same in Google in order to get, you know, local and refined search result.
Yeah, and the biggest revenue drivers of Facebook and Google are these SMEs. Like, you know, obviously they've got this massive heft from these big companies that spend billions with them. But actually the bulk of their revenue comes from these small to medium-sized businesses that are the mum and pop shops, that are the kind of the independent stores that are running a search campaign in a 30-mile radius of their store. Like, that's, and if that's what these big publishers can try and adopt the attitudes of Google and Facebook and Amazon to that degree as well as kind of these local independent sellers. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, one of the higher profile casualties of the move towards a more programmatic ecosystem of digital advertising has been local press, right? You know, they very widely written about some of the challenges that those organizations have had to their business models, as, you know, they have lost the relationships and the transaction to middlemen. And, you know, I guess outside of ad tech, quite a lot of folk are disappointed about that. You know, we talk about the quality of journalism. You know, I'm sharing the room with illustrious journalists here, so there's no problem here. But
that's you, Matt, not me. Yeah.
You know, in terms of the way issues are addressed at a national and a local level, I mean, I don't want to get too philosophical here. We are talking about ad stuff, but, you know, our industry and the way that we behave, allowing for perhaps a reinjection of revenue into those kind of environments is a good holistic thing, perhaps, rather than just an interesting observation for the ad tech market.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
completely agree. So changing tack slightly onto our final news story of the week, streaming platform Mixer has announced that it's rolling out ads on its platform. However, unlike Twitch, which is its more established rival at the moment, it's not currently disclosing where this revenue is going, and it's not currently going towards any of the creators on the site. So with the popularity of streaming increasing at a rapid rate, it's encouraging that advertisers are getting more opportunities to use this medium. However, this needs to be balanced with, you know, appropriate creator
remuneration. Are you going for that?
Yeah.
I always get it wrong.
Tongue twister there. So the question is, where do we see the future of this in terms of video streaming, the ad-funded revenue going in this, and will game creators benefit in the long run compared to just purely subscription?
I've caveated this. Gaming for me finished with Pro Evo on the PlayStation 2, right? So in terms of my specific knowledge, you're not going to get tons of insight about gaming, but I think for the industry and in terms of the broader ad economy, it's a really interesting space. Mm-hmm. So I would say, firstly, they're not going to have many of the stars on that platform if they don't pay them. I imagine is a prima facie economic observation about what's going on. I'm assuming that I'm not teaching Microsoft to suck eggs as far as that goes, right? So I'm assuming there is some way in which they would look to fund, particularly the premium and the stars of that environment. I mean, looking at what they're trying to do, firstly, are they just looking to differentiate versus Twitch, right? Because just producing Twitch 2 and calling it something else is not necessarily the strategy that you might want to adopt. So maybe there's some differentiation in terms of the way that they're looking to do it. Mm-hmm. I think they spoke about reinvesting in other ways to reward the people that use the platform. So sort of subsidizing other costs.
To me, that suggests that they're focusing more on the subscription model, which Twitch also has as well. And I think Mixer has been using previously, but it seems to be interesting to see, whereas Twitch seems to be going, right, creators are also getting the ad funding, whereas at the moment, at least on Mixer, they're kind of holding that back. And
yeah, and you know, that as I say, that may be a market differentiation piece. You know, they imagine for a minute you are someone that gets paid millions of dollars a year to play computer games. If you are those people and you're looking for somewhere to go, then clearly there needs to be some kind of a commercial incentive. But then there's also got to be some kind of differentiation, because as you say, otherwise why would you choose one over the other? So it will be interesting if they do go down that paid for, much more down that paid for approach, i.e. kind of a little bit like Spotify, have advertising as the kind of the don't you wish you had the better option, and then drive people to perhaps fund more through subscription and those kinds of revenue solutions rather than just pre-rolling everything and, you know, doing same old, same old. I mean, yeah. We'll see how it goes.
It's interesting because I think Twitch are very transparent about where the money goes. They're very transparent about this is what we get, this is what our creators get. And these creators are our partners and we want to make sure that we're keeping them happy. And the way that they, the different ad options when it comes to Twitch, which is, you know, kind of, I could be a creator sitting in my living room playing a game with a box of Kellogg's there. And that is a brand. That's an advertised opportunity with Kellogg's versus kind of the ad formats that appear on the screen and within the general UX, and of course the stitched ads that appear when someone's going off for a toilet break and those kind of things. There's tons of different ways that Twitch are monetizing their inventory and how they're working with the creators to make it more interesting and not feel like, oh well, I have to engage with ads because that's how I'm able to be able to use the Twitch platform. They're trying to make it as interesting as possible for both the creators and their users, which I think is very smart. Mixer, I don't really know a lot about Mixer. I can't say a lot about Twitch like I'm some big gamer because I'm absolutely not. But Mixer, if they aren't being transparent about that and where that money is going and how they are helping fund creators is an interesting one because Mixer aren't the bigger platform. So it's not like they've got tons of users coming their way. And so if they do manage to work out a model where they're able to attract all these users coming in and the users are sort of saying goodbye to Twitch and coming to Mixer instead, which at this stage seems unlikely, then the creators have no choice but to work with Mixer. And that might be a kind of bet the devil you know, how Google made a lot of money in the past. You know, that like build it and they will come, but unfortunately we're not going to pay you for it because these guys are here anyway, so we're just going to screw you over. I don't think Microsoft would do that.
No, I wouldn't necessarily think so because I think gaming audiences as a whole are quite sceptical of advertising. So the fact that they wouldn't necessarily be disclosed to as to where that revenue's going. They'd be like, oh, where's this going? It's just going to line Microsoft's pockets. This isn't going to help the creators, which I spend hours on a day watching. So
they're the one kind of, and I can't call gamers a demographic because within that, the demographic of graphic of gamers is so broad.
Yes,
but they are the one sort of subset that does actually understand the value exchange of if I watch ads, I know what I'm getting in return. And a big reason for that is that the creators explain to them the value exchange. The creators say, listen, guys, you're going to see some ads here. This box of Kellogg's, I'm being paid to do this. There is that not only is Twitch being transparent, but the creators and the partners that work with Twitch are also transparent, which you do see to a certain extent on YouTube with video advertising as well. And it would be crazy for YouTube not to allow their creators to subsidize and reimburse themselves when it comes to kind of how they're monetizing on their videos as well when it comes to advertising. But it is that there is that understanding. And I think that that's something that's lost in the rest of the universe. But that's why Mixer need to be slightly careful in a way, because that transparency is going to be lost and those gamers won't have it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they want that. I mean, I think slightly before this generational step of gaming as an industry in terms of that kind of live streaming mass participation, if you look at how the mobile app mobile app gaming economy grew, there was a very transparent transaction there, and there continues to be actually in terms of the way that mobile app inventory is viewed and executed against by advertisers. You know, there's the wider kind of tracking conversation about that, but you know, the paid for, the rewarded ad is born of that mobile app economy, isn't it? Watch, you know.
Oh, it's an incredible form of monetization.
Yeah,
advertisers are still scared of it. But,
well, exactly that. But it's lived in a little bit of a silo, and perhaps that's something you'll continue to see as. I don't know, it's not niche anymore, it's huge, but you know, the Twitch, the Mixer, you know, as we move into that kind of broader broadcast economy for gaming, that the transparency of that transaction to the user remains the same, I think.
I agree.
I mean, I guess, you know, you could talk about it for a long time, but we you know, people talk about the death of, you know, live in TV and how people are going to an on-demand TV economy, and on the flip side of that, you've got this kind of counterculture called live gaming where people, well, it's all live, right? It's all about the live stream. It's not on a TV channel. It's not necessarily regulated. You know, the way that the types of content that can be monetized or broadcast are not necessarily dealt with in the same way that the broadcasters have to deal with their live TV. It'll be also interesting to see how quickly they're caught up with as far as rules and regulation as well.
Good point, actually. It's a very good point.
You know, less and less people watching live TV, more and more people watching live online games.
The audiences are definitely there at the moment.
Yeah.
So it's a case of how how to capitalise.
Yeah, we should tell Barb. I'm sure they'll be interested. They can come.
Oh, they would. They'll try and squeeze it into Project Dovetail, probably.
Yeah, I believe it's still...
new way of measurement.
I think it's still happening. I'm not sure.
Right, so changing tack and moving into the second part of the podcast, we're going to be looking at the trends from Demexco, the trends from all the industry events that have been happening over the last few weeks, and looking at the kind of pincer movement between regulation in terms of the European DPAs, the US as we mentioned earlier, and also the browser level restrictions, the Apple ITPs, Firefox ETPs of the world, and how, you know, that's affecting advertising.
Can we just
forward.
Call them browser regulations? Yeah. Because
all of the TPs.
My ITPs is distinct
not
from,
another acronym.
Yeah, let's just call them browser regulations.
There, we'll do from now on.
Thank you. Yeah, so that was everyone's last week, wasn't it? And we were at the same...
come out of one of the biggest weeks in ad tech in Europe, in any case.
We were at the same event as well yesterday, weren't we, as well, with the AOP publisher session on some of those topics. I mean, I don't know how you felt. I mean, obviously, we won't talk about ATS too much. It's a fantastic event and everyone should go, right?
Thank you, Will. That's exactly what... This is not paid, not endorsed.
But, you know, we talked a little bit about, actually, when the amount of folk that left the auditorium when the ICO came on to talk a little bit about the their report on ad tech thus far and what the next 6 months might look like. I'm not quite sure how I felt about that. I kind of looked and thought, well, that's an interesting response. I'd like a cup of coffee too, but there may be some interesting things here for all of us to understand. But it's clear, you know, that there are those two parts of perhaps the same thing happening at the moment. There are the browsers as the primary custodian of the user, I suppose, really, in what we do. That's the piece that the user actually uses, responding to the state of privacy and the internet. And at the same time, you have, well, you don't have regulators regulating. That's happened. You know, the law has been established. It is with us. We now have the regulators talking more explicitly about starting to take action and what that might mean. And I think those two things have been very acute in the way that I've spoken to folks and had folks speak to me in the last 2 weeks of what's been an event season. I think I felt that Demexco was quieter, perhaps, than in previous years.
Yeah,
there was some floor space.
Yeah, there definitely was. There was people for guys like wider, us, yeah, wider for aisles.
Yeah, yeah, look, wider,
fewer stands.
And do you know what?
It's
I thought
less busy.
And I kind of thought that was great. You know, the wider aisles was a nice touch. You know, you could actually navigate the halls much more easily. There were some communal sofas where you could sit down. We don't host a booth at Demexco at the Media Trust, so it's great for us. You know, there's places you can sit down and meet with folks without, you know, having to be at a booth. But the other thing that I thought about it was, despite all of those dynamics, there was no less work to be done.
Yeah.
So I wonder if my observation is that, you know, some of the, however you want to describe it, you know, some of the fat is starting to fall out of it, whatever it may be, you know, out of you know, those kind of events. But in terms of the meetings that have to be done and you know, the people that you speak to, there was absolutely no drop in quality, perhaps just less filler. But it's clear that folks are feeling, from a marketing point of view, perhaps a little bit more nervous about those kinds of things. And then I guess on the flip side of it, we were at the AOP event yesterday, where we were talking quite specifically about the impact of browser privacy and how that will affect organisations. And, you know, the topic yesterday was certainly around publishing. And if we talk about programmatic 1.0 or whatever the we've been living up to this point, that has relied on the concept of a user identifier.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
And this ecosystem has been built on the concept that an advertiser will choose to whom it wants to buy an advert. And a lot of those decisions will have very little to do with the user and not an awful amount to do with the publisher as well. So those are definitely shifting dynamics. And there are obviously some folks who are very attuned to that and are reacting, and there are equally some other folks who seem to be less attuned to that and seem to have their heads in the sand. But the next, I think the next, well, it's 4 months left now, isn't it? But,
yeah,
you know, the rest of this year, as far as the ICO's kind of small time out.
Yeah, I mean, I think, referring to kind of publishers, and some of them know what's going on and are trying their best to do what they can to, firstly, be compliant. Secondly, navigate all of this and understand what the browsers are doing versus what the regulators are doing and everything in between. But then the others that do bury their heads in the sand, they might pull their heads out of the sand for a little bit and go, oh, I'm just going to check what's going on. Oh, no, it's still absolute chaos. I don't know what's going on. Right, I'm going back in again. And I wonder if your comment about, you know, we had, Will, as you said, we had Ali Shah, the head of technology policy from the ICO on stage at ATS London. And as you said, some people left the room. And it's surprising, given the importance of what the ad tech update report has said and the importance of the ICO in this industry as our DPA, why they would not want to be part of that conversation.
Yeah, I think you were all of 2.5 minutes late behind schedule.
Yes, at that point we were. It didn't last that long, but yeah.
It's enough to, yeah, I just thought it was a very strange thing. And I don't know if we as an industry need to see something, I'll take that back. We do, lots of people in this industry do need to see something happen for it to become real.
Yeah.
I think for some people it feels like a conversation. But let me tell you, for our clients, it is very real, particularly in the publishing community, the amount of work that has gone on in the publishing community to be compliant is incredible. You know, the work that we do with our partners around identification of tracking cookies and scripts, where they come from, who put them there, how to remediate perhaps a placement that isn't consented versus one that is, that's a good amount of work to be putting onto people, and we're happy to help. But as far as the burden of that work, it has generally fallen into publishing to deliver that. I'm not the regulator, but I would expect that for someone like the ICO to look at the amount of work that's happened there versus the lack of work that may have happened in other places, I'm not sure that's where we're going to see action first of all. But there's no doubt that there has to be some reality soon, I think.
Yeah, that doesn't mean that we can continue to just shy away from it.
No.
And on the flip side of whoever may have left the room, you know who you are. there were also, when Ali came off stage, he was also mobbed by people that wanted to come and speak to him and say, look, I want to chat to you, I want to meet with you, tell me more, this is fascinating. And I've spoken to a lot of people since who've said, oh yeah, no, I've got an individual meeting with ICO very soon to discuss this in more detail. So it's really positive to see that actually for everyone that did decide to walk out of the room and not address the situation that's going on in our industry, there were enough people, if not more, that really took it on board and really took it seriously.
Yeah, well, I think that engagement is vital. And I suppose when there is something coming up, I mean, we've all felt it, haven't we? You know that anxiety where, you know, I don't know, when you're a student and you know you've got to submit your paper in 10 days, and whenever you think about it, you kind of go, ugh.
Well, as many as 10 days.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? The idea of going to see your tutor and saying, oh my goodness, there's only 10 days to go, can you help me with it? You'd just do anything to avoid them avoid their eye contact. And maybe there's a little bit of that going on in terms of, oh my goodness, the ICO is actually here. Maybe if I hide, they won't know I'm in the business. But there needs to be that engagement. And I actually thought that it was Ash, wasn't it? The guy on stage from the ICO.
Ali.
Sorry. It was Ali, wasn't it? I thought he spoke very well. And, you know, the message really was, we genuinely want to have a dialogue with you guys. You know, we're not here to cause anyone undue, you know, pressure or damage. We want to talk to you about how this is going to be.
Mm.
I think we've all got to wake up to that.
Yeah, it's the kind of, their message has been, it needs to happen across the industry. There needs to be industry level changes, but there also has to be the industry showing good faith, and those that aren't are the ones that are going to be kind of highlighted within that.
I think we've also got to acknowledge it is going to change, right? There is going to be some change. The concept of open RTB buying particularly, but more generally programmatic advertising, has been about the acquisition of a user. or the buying of an ad placement against the user based on what you as an advertiser know about that user. And very often that has had little, as I said to you, very little engagement with those folk who supply that advert. It's not my favourite term, but you know, people who pay journalists to write content who happen to have ads on the page to create those adverts. It, you know, has had less and less to do with that environment and, you know, those businesses as a publisher. I think we are going to see an equalisation of those things, and there will always be a tension because the status quo is very much about how buyers wish to buy adverts against user data. There's going to have to be an equalisation of that, because I don't think that we're just going to be able to, you know, take cookies away and replace it with something else that is a user identifier. I don't think the regulators have a problem with cookies in particular. I think they have an issue with consent and privacy and tracking.
It's how we're using the cookies.
It's how it's used. So cookie-less in and of itself is of no consequence. It's more about outcome.
Mm.
And we're going to have an equalisation of that. You know, an entirely context-driven internet is going to be a challenge. But we've already seen that an entirely user-identified internet's not going to fly.
It's not the solution.
So, you know, we can become angry about both of those extreme positions if we want to, or we're going to have to work to something in the middle which satisfies users, satisfies the regulation, and also satisfies the industry and the people that work in it.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you think that, obviously, you work very closely with publishers, and it feels like everyone's telling them, oh, you're in a great position, that this is great for you, you get more control, you get a closer connection with your users, you get to start rebuilding those relationships again. But on top of that, there's also seems to be, but they're also, all of the onus, all the responsibility is then also on them as well. Well, it shouldn't just be on them, because actually it shouldn't just be down to the publisher to not solve this, but down to the publisher to take all of this on their own shoulders.
Yeah, and I mentioned the work that we do with publishing around compliance and data compliance and GDPR, and for our clients in the US, you know, the California regulation is coming, and you know, whilst slightly different in its finesse, will look a lot like GDPR in terms of execution. That generally has slid to publishers as the owners of that point of that relationship with the user, and there's been a lot of work that has gone into that. And if you think about what's preceded that, there's also been a lot of work, particularly at the publisher level, in getting to a point where the amount of ad tech that is put in their direction, they've been able to understand and how to execute and how to optimize. And you think about how they've had to go through the evolutions of ad serving and waterfalls and then headers and EBDA, and they don't call it EBDA anymore, they call it something. You think about how you have to go through and almost relearn your commercial strategy every 6 months in order to kind of stand your position as far as revenues go. It's probably coming again, right? And we're seeing it already. We talked about Washington Post, right? They've got the ability to build some. You can understand why publishers feel like they would like some skin in the game now, as far as this goes, and it will be another set of work that needs to be done. But I think that it again, you know, I'd say the same thing. It would be good if we could get to a more equalised position. You know, we work with ad tech companies and with publishers. We understand all of their interests in this. But I think what's coming is something that lives a little bit closer to the user and the publisher than it currently does in the buyer and the agency. I think that's going to be where we're going to get to.
Yeah. And do you think that, obviously, we talked about coming out the biggest week of ad tech for Europe in terms of events. Do you think that everyone's come out of that? Obviously, there's a lot of talk going on at the moment. Do you think there's now going to be a lot of action?
Are you not moved to... Everyone's moved to action the week after events.
Oh, absolutely,
you've got a long to-do list.
I've not been lying crying in my bed for the past 3 days, wondering whether I'll recover. Of course not.
That's not what you told me before we recorded. I do, it's happening, right? We had some topics today to talk about. You know, we talked about what's happening in publishing. We talked about that technology piece. That is genuinely happening. I think that the commitment that businesses are showing to that is very real. You know, we talked about, you know, what's happening with the National Press and the Ozone Project. that's JV, that's a business that they own, that's something they're committed to. I think that, you know, I believe and they believe that that's going to make a, you know, an absolute change to the way that they're able to run their commercial models. I bet that if you spoke to folk at the Washington Post, they would feel the same way too. So that inertia is happening. I think that, you know, the last couple of weeks, like, we've had, you know, lots of mixing and socialising and talking to folk about what's going on. I think that will crystallise, you know, the dynamics in the market, I think will crystallise in a lot of people's minds. You know, I always find it quite cathartic when I talk to people who do what I do. Do you know what I mean? Like, more broadly, because I don't always talk to people that do what I do. You know, if I'm talking to my clients, we tend to have kind of mirrored relationships. You know, they do this and I help them with that, whereas when you get in a room with a whole bunch of people who's have similar customer sets and do what you do, it's always quite cathartic. You know, you're like, I'm not the only one who feels like this, or I'm not the only one that feels like that. And it's kind of a, you know, I imagine that we all get together for ATS, we'll get together to Mexico, and everyone's like, actually, this is happening. Yes, this is real. You know, when I talk to folks about what's happening, they feel the same way. Maybe there is sort of a bit of an emotional backstop happening there, allowing people to be like, okay, this is happening. But 2020 will look very different to 2019. I think this year we've all taken a deep breath and thought, right, okay, we're bracing ourselves, and it's going to happen. I think next year, you know, it's going to happen. And what we can really do is participate in that change, because if you don't participate in change, then it happens to you, and that's generally not the best outcome for you as an individual. So we all need to participate in that to do things a little bit better, I think.
Yeah. As Ali Shah said at HS London, the tide is coming in, right?
Yeah.
But it might just be the tide that kind of just laps at your feet rather than engulf you.
Yeah, but I think that's the attitude which we can't have. It has to be...
You're absolutely right, Matt.
Have the opinion of, this is going to happen, what can we do about it?
Take it seriously.
Yeah.
Yeah, but also embrace it, right?
Yeah.
Because
it's not a negative. These are not negatives.
Like you said, change, there's so many opportunities there, especially for the publishers.
Change is a real problem for folk, or for anyone, right? For life or business, change is a real problem if what you're changing from is something is, do you know what I mean? If you've got something, if you're in a perfect position and you're forced to change, you're like, I don't think anyone thinks you're in a perfect position.
No.
Right? We're much better informed, we've got better technology, we've got better understanding, we've got open dialogue now with the folks that, you know, as far as regulation goes, and, you know, that dialogue is happening. There is an opportunity to do some things that will take those pressures away if we do them correctly. Mm-hmm. And I think you've got to embrace it. Be some work, as you said. You know, will the work come back to publishers? Probably. Will there be some pressure on behaviours upstream and in the platforms? Absolutely. You know, like absolutely,
because there has to be.
Yeah. Will buyers just be able to execute campaigns on IDs like they always have done? No. Will they also have to put a bit of blood, sweat and tears into the way that they monetize and allocate? Yep. But that's... I don't mind that. That should be a good thing if we can rejig into something that works better. Because it's not really, you know... I think on one of the panels, someone said, do users really care? You know, we talk about regulation and something.
I think it was your panel, Will. It was a transparency panel.
I'm being diplomatic. Yeah. Like, it wasn't my panel.
You know, damn well.
But... Someone was like, do users really care? And I was like, whoa, I think we've passed that, aren't we?
Yeah, well, I'd like to think we are. But then that's an interesting thing, because it was an American that said that. And like we've had to have a very, very different stance in Europe now, because it's been forced upon us. They're not quite there yet, so they are still thinking, do users care? It doesn't matter whether they care or not.
I had a brief glance through. I'm not familiar with all the wording of the regulation, but there's certainly not a section on users caring very much.
Exactly.
Like, we're kind of past that, right?
Like you said earlier, it's the law. It's already there. It's a case of how you enact it. In terms of the Americans, not at this point, but they've kind of built on it from GDPR, so it's already there in framework itself.
Yeah,
so
it'll be interesting in the US, because I've, you know, when I speak to colleagues and customers in the US, don't forget they also have a very different enforcement culture. So, as an industry, we are looking to be led by the regulators, and we're talking about how the law will impact and be affected. Whereas, of course, there is a little bit more litigation goes on in the US, perhaps, than goes on in the UK. And, you know, if enforcement is not at a kind of state prosecution level, you bet that there's going to be some private enforcement going on. I would imagine that, you know, some class actions might come along for personal reward, and rather than, you know, the way that we're much more British about it, aren't we? We'll wait and see what the rules are going to be, and then we'll toe the line. You know, that may well be what happens in the US. I don't know. I mean, anecdotally, as I said, there's some of the conversations I've had with people. And, you know, you better believe if a big corporation is being chased up in that way for compliance rather than by
millions of people. I think that's, I've had many a call with lawyers that are representing companies, not individuals, of course, that are taking a class action lawsuit against the likes of Facebook or Google or those other big companies in the industry. And it's fascinating when you hear it versus what we, like, our approach in the UK, in Europe, and actually the rest of the world. It could easily be the case that these consumers all band together, because GDPR created a cottage industry in the UK. It will do more than that in the US. It will be a cottage industry, but for users, not just kind of companies trying to be compliant. It's going to be fascinating to watch.
Yeah, and there's the scale thing as well, right? So there were organisations that retreated from their European operations on the back of GDPR. I don't think, you know, that retreat would have been disappointing for those businesses, and they wasn't terminal. It was just, you know what,
easier for them to the effort would have taken to be compliant. It was easier for them to pull out, and it wouldn't have massively impacted their business.
Not the same for their US operations.
Yeah, exactly.
Not the same. So if they avoided, careful, I mean avoided, but you know, if they deferred if they decided to defer some tough decisions in their organisation, no more time left.
No.
Yeah.
No. Winter is coming.
Yeah. That brings us to a lovely positive conclusion.
The tide's coming in.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
No, my pleasure.
And Lindsay, thank you for joining us too.
Naturally, you're
and
welcome.
Thank you for listening.